C1PR. Number 7A.
Now, we come to the second subject, the subject which we may epitomize as the prayer of true worship or the prayer of true devotion or the prayer of worshipping the good. Well, there may be so many epitomes, it's not always easy to bring everything down to a very short common denominator. But the spirit of it may be characterized like this. In the chapter, or in the first subject, we had that prayer of desire to know God as He is. It was only the desire to know. It was the desire to look out for God as He is. It was the big vision. And now, after having presented in a big way what God is as He is, what He does as He does, now the second subject comes and says more or less, now take that vision into your heart. Go and worship that which you desire and which we have visualized in mind. So to say, links up now the first subject, takes that whole first subject which was visionary and says, now that what you have now in a visionary way seen and perceived, go and take it in your heart and love it and worship it and adore it and keep it warm. It is, so to say, depicting the means which must be used in order that this vision becomes nearer and nearer to our heart. The means, the spiritual means, so to say. It's quite interesting how she opens this second subject. She says, the divine being must be reflected by man. It's interesting that she says, the divine being must be reflected by man. In the later chapters in the Christianity chapters, she wouldn't say that. She would say, man reflects God. But in the approach, it is quite different. In the approach, first, thought has to be wakened up and say, well, the divine being must be reflected by man, or else man can never be God's image and likeness. So what shall we do about it? And so she touches the point of reflection at its deepest level, but it's still reflection. And that's beautiful. How often have we thought about reflection and have thought and thought, and somehow we have little by little perhaps touched something of that word reflection. But perhaps we have never been quite satisfied how man shall reflect God. I remember in the church how people tried to reflect God by smiling, you know, smiling. Because God is so lovely, well, if man reflects God, well, we have just smile. Be nice, you see, and say some nice things. Well, here too, she has to speak to the beginner and says, well, what can a beginner who has not the slightest knowledge of what reflection means, what does it mean for him? And so, in this second subject, she introduces, through spiritual qualities, the meaning of reflection. She never uses the word reflection anymore in that second subject, but she sets the subject, and now she develops that subject on the level where we are, where the beginner who has only read two pages is. And it is nice to see how she does it. Now, we know from our study of the synonymous terms that spirit is that which governs reflection. But what does spirit reflect? Spirit reflects only its own nature. Therefore, spirit reflects only itself and on itself. It does never reflect anything else. So, if man has to reflect God, he certainly has to reflect it through the nature of spirit. Here, at its initial stages of the second day of creation, as that sense of brooding over what we know, that's reflection. We reflect on what we know. It's brooding over it. It's reflecting on the good we already know. And it isn't that sense of getting something, which we usually have in a prayer. In prayer we usually have, in common sense of the prayer, we usually have the sense, I want to get something from God. It's a sense of accretion, that something is added from outside to me. It's adding something on me. Whereas here she says, no. She says, you must reflect on what you already know. The little that has sprung up in mind through the first subject, that little, which, if it is on the nature of God, is good. However little it is good, and it's of the nature of God. A little dewdrop just reflects the whole of God, not just a little bit, the whole of God. And the least little seed is acceptable unto God. And it is only a question if we can nurture that seed. If we can give to that seed its proper ground, it's on can nurture it and manure it. So we just have to manure our consciousness a little bit and give to our soil really that which is needed, so that little good which we already have is going to unfold. We know from spirit, from our high-bound metaphysical knowledge of spirit, that like produces like. All right. If we bring it down right here where we are, what does it mean that like produces like? It means in prayer that I can only get more through what I already have of the divine. Because if only the divine can produce the divine, only the spiritual can produce the spiritual. Therefore, if my prayer is for more, I can only have it by using that which I already have, because only that which I already have of the divine can produce like and can unfold. So this wonderful second subject takes us away from that sense, how do I get more blessing? How can God give me more blessing? As if he could add a bucket full more of blessing and then another pound of blessing to it. And here we say, no, it's reflection. Man must reflect God. Well, if there is not infinity to reflect, all right, let's reflect what we know already. And the little seed is acceptable unto God. And so we find here that gentle sense that no matter how much we have of God, the little we have is enough to let it unfold and to let it unfold so that it becomes stronger, more endurable, and stronger and more endurable until it is so strong that it can resist any opposition. So you see the difference which this second subject brings. In the first subject, it was vision, which said to us, don't be small, don't be little, don't be narrow, don't be finite. Any prayer which regards God in a little way, which looks for God in a little way and in a narrow way, is no scientific prayer at all. God is all and in. Well, thought says, well, that's a lot, I don't have it. Yes. The second prayer comes and says, now nurture that thought, nurture that desire, feed it. Feed the good we already know, and we know already a little bit of good. We know quite a good bit of God. And it's only a question in us if we are dissatisfied with that or satisfied with knowing it. If we are dissatisfied, then we look outward from us for more. And that is impossible. Reflection is to be grateful for what we already have. To be reflection means to be grateful for the little we already have, and to love that little we already have, and to care for it, and to protect it, and to give it the warmth and the tenderness and the importance and the value. And that's what the second subject means. It's a question of how much love we give to that which we already have. That's the second prayer. And each one of us has something of God, which we already have. See, it's love. And with love here, I don't mean love as we have it in the fifth day. That is love in a different way. Greater love has nobody than he lays down his life for his fellow men. That's life. Here you don't. We are not asked to lay down anything. Here we are asked to let the tares grow, but to look after the wheat, to love the wheat. It's only the effect. Here it's, the love is only the love for the good. It's not yet the love that is willing to lay down the mortal. It's that love which is affection, which says, all my affection goes out for the good. All my affection goes out for what I have seen of the divine. All my affection goes out to see that that which I know of the divine outweighs the whole world. That nothing is can be compared to that. That everything is just nothing compared to that. Just little and insignificant to that. That's the love of the second day. So don't hang on words. It's the tone. It's the heart that speaks. And so you can see how the first subject really depicts more the what you call the male sense or the masculine sense, the creative sense. It's the visionary sense. In the second, it's the woman sense, the conceptive sense, where you say, well, that which has been brightened up and lighted up in my consciousness, I can't just let it go like this. I have to take it in into me. I have to take it in and love it and cherish it and hug it and keep it to my bosom and carry it around with me and always reflect on it, think on it, and love it. That's the woman. She does that. So we can't get around the fact that we have to be both. The one needs the other. If we would start with the second subject of loving God, we would be hopelessly astray, because we would love an unknown God. We would love a God which we have not cleared up through the first subject, what is God? And we would worship and love and cherish a God which is not God. So we can't start with the second. See, the order of the days of creation is irresistible. It's the biggest thing that has ever been discovered. Starting with mind. Without starting with mind and having first getting a clear, correct vision of what God is, we cannot love God. We cannot go to the second. We cannot put that God first. So, here in this second subject, I would love you to read it through and through and make some notes on the question 14 and 15, where I ask those questions, well, what are the means of prayer? What are the positive means of prayer? And what are the negative means of prayer? If you look it up, we get here those qualities as the means of prayer. We could also call it, what is the language of prayer? Through what means can we get nearer and nearer to God? What are the means of worship? Or what is the substance or material out of which prayer must consist of? Well, here she says, it is, and she counts up about a dozen of those spiritual qualities. She doesn't use the term idea in the whole first chapter. She doesn't use it. It's down on the level where we are, where the tone of the synonymous terms just shine a little bit through the mist and present themselves on that level where we are, where it is not impossible for us to grasp the divinity of the subject. So she says, the means, the language of prayer is absolute consecration, it's gratitude, it's to availing ourselves of the blessing, is to express gratitude, is to remember our blessing, it's fervent desire for growth in grace, is expressing patience, meekness, love, good deeds. It's expressing it in keeping the commandments, in following the Master's example, in loyal and heartfelt gratitude, in a habitual struggle to be always good, in a longing to be better and holier, in daily watchfulness, in striving to assimilate more of the divine character, in demonstrating the divine nature, in patience, in watchfulness, in devout obedience. Can you see the tone? Quite different from the first one. It's just as different as black and white. In the first one, it was that sense of desire which had to clear up step by step. Here, it's the substance, the warmth of it, the spiritual qualities of it, which are here depicted, are the means, the material of prayer through which we reach the spiritual. It is our spiritual qualities, and only spiritual qualities can reach the spiritual. So, as a whole, we get here that warmth of brooding over that which we have learned in mind in the first subject. And by it, naturally, we give birth. See, it is as if in the first subject she said to us, you know, I show you the big vision of God. And that idea is great. That vision is great. It's infinite, it's boundless, it's great. Second subject comes and says, all right, then take that vision in your womb. Open wide your womb and ask us not to be small and little in our devotion, in our worship. Whereas on the other side, she shows that outward worship, now the wrong means of worship, that they are not doing anything. Well, it's all about outward worship, about insincerity, and about admitting God theoretically, and so, you see, it has not the spirit in it. It is outward, it's material, it's verbal, and all that thing. Also, when we go through this chapter and ponder it, we'll see how she couples, so to say, that quality of worship, of expressing spiritual qualities with unfoldment. You know, we had on the spirit, we had worship and unfoldment. But how are they linked together? We say, well, spirit unfoldment, we expect something happening by S-P-I-R-I-T. That S-P-I-R-I-T is going to unfold something. It can't. Just a few letters. But the second day is a day of consciousness, is a state of the heart, of the loving heart. And that is of the nature of the true spirit, not of the letter of spirit. And that has in itself the power to unfold, to progress, to bring forth, to give the new birth. And this interplay of true worship and unfoldment is brought out time and time and time in this short little paragraphs of the second day. It shows time and time how through availing ourselves of the blessings we have, you see that wonderful quality of being grateful for the big little we have, we are fitted to receive more. It's unfoldment. And in that way, there is one statement after the other, just saying that wonderful interplay. You can take those statements out of the text for yourself, and it's interesting to show them, it's deep to show them, because it impresses on us that unfoldment is not something which is just going to happen because I have a knowledge of spirit and know what ideas symbolize spirit. Unfoldment is something which is going to happen out of that ground where the root is sown, the root is in the ground of warmth and of worship and of devotion and of spiritual qualities. Out of that ground the seed can grow and unfold. That's the interplay of worship and unfoldment. Then it is a spiritual fact and the spiritual law operating. Then we have taken it away from the merely literal and intellectual and the knowledgeable. And it's quite interesting to see how she points out that time and time again. Just saying what? Just saying that, well, the moment we worship spiritually, something is bound to happen. That's that prayer. In the first prayer she says, unless we open our thought to God as He is, nothing can happen. Then it says, now if we worship that vision, something is bound to happen. There is unfoldment, and we will get strength and spiritual strength, and then power over error. These are the very rudimental laws which seem to come out of these subjects. Laws which are so simple in itself, but sometimes we just don't think of them and see their depths. So let me go quickly through the subtones. First, she starts right away, as I said, with that big statement, as if sometimes very interesting to see the first statement of a new subject. It is as if she would depict the proposition and then, through all the subtones, comment on that proposition. Here it is said that divine being must be reflected by man, or man must be the reflection of what? She doesn't say of God. She doesn't say of spirit. She says of the patient, tender, true, the one altogether lovely. I'm always impressed in that first chapter how gently she introduces big statements. Here, that wonderful statement that God is spirit, she introduces through that gentle sense and says, I don't use that word, spirit. The reader may not know rightly what I mean by it. So I depict it as the patient, the tender, the true, the altogether lovely, and you get the warmth of it, of spirit. Spirit then isn't cold, as if she would have said, well, he is the likeness of spirit, as she will say later on. When thought has grasped a little bit what spirit means, when it has grasped the warmth of spirit. So here it's lovely to see how she says, all right, let's think of spirit first through the qualities which we attribute to spirit as tender, the patient, tender, the true, the altogether lovely. And it gives a warm feeling. Anyway, it does to me. So if man must reflect that warmth of God, then we see that therefore she appeals to all those qualities in us which she can presuppose to be in each one of us and just mobilize, so to say, those qualities. Says, unless we don't reflect God, we will never understand God. How interesting. She said, through that warmth, we will understand God. It is as if she here would say, I mean, no understanding as an idea of spirit, but she says, you will understand it. But then she goes right again back to the nearer and says, all right, how do you get that understanding? And then she depicts it through those spiritual qualities first. And so she says, all right, you go about that in order to get this understanding, that demands what? And then she begins. Says, well, it demands absolute consecration of thought, energy, and desire. One of the definitions of absolute is unadulterated. It demands unadulterated consecration, energy, and desire. Now, that is asking not too much, insofar that everybody knows what is meant by it. Everybody knows what is consecration of energy and desire. The question is only if we want to give it. That's the question. But she doesn't speak on a level which the reader, when he is honest and sincere, cannot grasp. It's speaking on a level which the seeker, the beginner, can grasp. It's only a question if he wants to accept it. But here she shows the rule of it. Says, all right, the first thing is I demand your worship of the mind. I demand the worship of your intellectual capacities. What I demand is consecration. It's worshiping. It's focusing. All those terms of spirit. Of what? All your mental capacities. Your desire, your energy, your love, and so on. So here I would caption it and say, well, reflecting God demands first absolute consecration of thought, energy, and desire.